Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
I just hit the record button. I'm standing here with Paulie Heyman. Paul Dangerously. Paulie Heyman. It's Paul Dangerously. Okay, so here it is. So we were hanging around here in New Orleans here at the hotel, and I just got finished eating breakfast. Kevin Nash walked to the green room. See you about 40 yards away. A big smile on your face. A big smile on my face. A big ass hug. Hey, what are you doing? Nothing. Just hanging around. Can you do a podcast? When? Now. So here we are. I haven't done any research. We know each other pretty damn well. And so here we are. WrestleMania 30. You grew up in the business. All of a sudden now, 30 years down the road, what does WrestleMania 30 mean to you?
Well, it's the evolution of the industry. I mean, once WCW and ECW all folded into WWE and it was the consolidation of the industry, it truly became the centerpiece event of the year. So to me, this is where the 2013-2014 season ends and the 2014-2015 season begins.
But it's bigger than ever. I mean, the wrestling keeps growing. And right when you think it can't get any bigger, they go to a bigger building, it blows out, and it's just it's a phenomenon.
Well, consider who the promoter is. I mean, that's...
Back in the day, Jesus Christ, you know, to come up with the idea to go pay-per-view, and now all the success and all the mainstream stuff that goes with it.
Oh, wasn't the first WrestleMania just on closed circuit?
Yeah.
I think it's the second one where he went pay-per-view, and he did New York, Chicago, and L.A., and, I mean, listen... Vince has always, and you know this better, far better than I do, you know, Vince has always been the big thinker, and he doesn't like to do anything on a small basis. And like any corporate owner, this year's quarter better exceed last year's quarter or your stock goes down. And ultimately, what the company is about today is about the stock price. So in order to drive that stock price up, your earnings capacity have to be bigger this year. You have to beat projections this year more than you beat last year. And to Vince, that means a bigger spectacle.
Okay, so we're talking about big spectacles. Let's talk briefly about the WWE Network. When you heard about this, what were your thoughts? I mean, because it's groundbreaking. You know, another cool moment. And this also, speaking to your stock stuff, drives the stock prices up. Have you subscribed to the network yet?
Well, anybody who works for the company gets a free subscription.
Ain't nobody told me that. I technically still work with the company. Well, how come I ain't got no free pass?
I think technically is the first word to work for the company. Yeah. And I don't know how many of their phone calls you actually return during the year.
Gotcha. So have you been on the network? How is it?
I have been on the network. My kids are on it far more than I am, and they get to tease me a lot because they get to see all my old footage, which I thought I could block on YouTube, but now I can't because it's on the network. I like the new stuff. Hey, here's what I find about the network. Again, I kind of look at it from a different perspective than most people. I look at it as a former promoter and understanding that the choke point when you are a promoter, it comes down to two things: one, content, and two, distribution. Now, in some people, it's financing, but this company's always been very well financed.
Right.
But you have the monster of content to feed, and then you have the monster of distribution to find. So what Vince did was brilliant. He self-distributed. Because he realized that any distribution that he has, the distributors are going to take the money, which was his beef with pay-per-view to begin with. So now he self-distributes. It's all his. It's all the shareholders. It's all for the company. And it was the right move to make. I also got to say, I think it was the only real move for him to make.
Right.
Because had he gone the route of buying a smaller cable network to expand it, like what Oprah did, Oprah went $300 million in.
Right.
You're gambling the entire store that way. If this network were to go completely wrong for him, he has an escape valve. He doesn't have to lose the company on it. The other ways, you're gambling the whole farm.
Right.
Or the ranch, whichever the
case. Let's go to the ranch. Okay, hey, back in the day, before even you and I started hanging around together, when you started managing me, you had the big-ass cell phone. Did you ever think that the business would evolve to what it has today? Just as far as the technology, the WWE Network, with WrestleMania being this big. Because we were living the times of our life, and we still are, but you're still in the business. It was such a grassroots affair back then. And with all the technology, with all the production values, it just keeps increasing and keeps changing. The product has changed inside the ring.
Oh, again, I think that has to do with the distribution channels that are out there. I mean, could we have envisioned where technology would be today? Back then, we're talking about now, you and I worked together in 1991 and 1992. So back then, again, it was the age of big-ass cell phones. It was the age of mimeographs. You put a cassette into a tape player in a car. Now, if I were to turn to my kids today and go, hey, put the tape in, they're going to look at me like, okay, daddy's really old and he's talking about back in his day.
Yeah.
So, it's all about distribution channels. We live in a global village to where right now, whatever is happening in Sydney, Australia, or Johannesburg, or Tel Aviv, or Athens, or London, or Paris, or Rome, you can see on your FaceTime. You can FaceTime with your family right now. So when you're on the road back then, you have to pull over to payphone. You had to call from a cell phone, which is expensive. You have to wait to get your hotel room and call your family. I can be right now completely around the world. I can be in Antarctica and I can FaceTime with my children.
Right.
It's distribution. And Vince went with the distribution channels that was out there. And if he didn't, someone else would have. If Ted Turner had seen the distribution channels, then no matter how bad the creative was at WCW, they would have still be alive.
Hey, man, you've had your highs and lows with WWE. Knockdown, dragouts. And I'm surprised it's still with the company. And you're cutting badass promos every single week. I didn't envision you, being a part of the company, because it seems like, man, when y'all had a falling out, it was a big-ass falling out for whatever reason it was. And so now you're happy as a clam. How is the current regime here and current day WWE?
I think I have a much better relationship with them now because they don't get to see me that often. I'm not on the writing team. I'm not involved in creative.
Do you miss that?
No.
Why?
Because I had the time of my life doing it, but that's over. And it's.
But do you still have that part of your brain where it's like, God, she would like to chip in on some of this stuff? Or are you doing it within your and Brock's storylines?
I chip in on the things that I'm directly involved in, and if I have something to say about something that I see, I will speak to the person directly. So if they want to pitch it, they're welcome to, and right. If they don't, then they don't have to. I don't get emotionally involved in the other segments of the show anymore.
Right.
I've learned to just say, okay, that's what they want to do. Good for them. Now, if a talent comes up to me and say, hey, did you watch my segment?
Yeah.
They may get a very intense, passionate answer.
Right.
But I'm not willing to fight to the death over two words that are in a promo anymore.
Now, coming from your background, I put you over in a million interviews because it's all true. You helped me so much when I went down to ECW with the superstar Steve Austin. The phone call, you were the first guy to call me. Steve, what are you doing? Nothing. I got a busted arm. I want you to come work for me. Can't work. Got a busted arm. Anyway, you helped me, harness and focus my energy and develop a good promo. So that being said, with all the success that you had at ECW with helping all these different personas, characters, people define themselves and turn out great gimmicks and promos, how much of the current roster is coming up to you on a daily basis saying, Paulie, check this out, or ask, like we just talked about, your opinion of something, and ask for your advice as a teacher, a mentor?
A lot, you know, and it's funny because I used to be the kid in the locker room that had all these ideas that could revolutionize the business. And now I'm the old guy in the locker room with these ideas that I hope can still revolutionize the business. I just don't give them to the promoters or try to feed them to the other writers or producers slash agents anymore. Now when a talent comes up to me, if a Bray Wyatt will come up to me or a Roman Reigns or a Seth Rollins or a Dean Ambrose or any of these, or and even from, you know, from the girl side, an AJ Lee, a Natty Neidhart will come up to me and they'll ask me something. I'll give them an answer from my perspective. And I that's the avenue for my passion in terms of helping somebody out or sharing a vision with somebody.
What's your current schedule on the road? You're living in New York, right?
Yes.
So how often are you on the road?
Rare now. Now I'm pretty much on Brock's schedule, plus I make the TVs that he doesn't make. So I leave home on Sundays. I make TVs on Mondays. If they need me on SmackDown, I'll go to SmackDown on Tuesdays. And I go home the first flight in the morning the next day. Now, before this, when CM Punk and I were opposing each other, it got so hot that I started making all the house shows again. And I did that for a couple months and burned myself out and desperately needed a few weeks off to recharge the batteries until Brock came back. My schedule is a blessing right now. I really work very, very little.
You brought up CM Punk. I don't know when this podcast is going to come out. It will be after WrestleMania. I predicted a couple weeks ago that CM Punk will return at WrestleMania 30. Here we are talking. Is he going to come back?
We are 48 hours away from WrestleMania, and unless a really wild move is pulled before then, or at least a first conversation between Vince and Punk happens, he will not be at WrestleMania.
When's the last time you talked to CM Punk?
Oh, I talk to him all the time. I don't really talk about the industry that much because it's obviously a sore spot with him. But when you left the company, I'm sure you had very select friends that you could talk with. And who could talk with you? And it doesn't have to be, hey, what was said about me in the locker room, or hey, did you hear anything? Or they say to you, hey, you're coming back. I'm sure it could be, hey, how are your kids? Hey, how are you feeling today? Hey, you're okay? Everything cool or everything not okay? You want to talk about anything? When I left the company, I stayed very good friends with people who were still in the company. It doesn't mean just because Punk has left the company, we can't be friends. Our friendship really had, funny thing to say, but it really had nothing to do with business.
Right.
I think when you talk about CM Punk slash Phil Brooks, there were three people in the room the night that he quit. Vince McMahon, Triple H, and CM Punk. I don't know what went on in that room. I know certain perspectives, but none of those three have talked in public about it. If one, two, or three of them decide to go public, then we'll get a perspective on what happened that day. Until one of the three of them speak about it, it's only rumor and speculation and gossip. You know, how's he doing? He's fine. Does he miss the business? I don't think so. I never ask him if he misses the business because he just walked out 6 to 8 weeks ago. I ask him, how you doing? How you feeling today? How's your diet going? What'd you eat? Hey, did you watch the season finale of True Detective? We talked about True Detective on for hours, but do we talk about WWE? It's very rare.
I've been meaning to watch True Detective. Everybody says it's a badass show. Should I watch it?
Absolutely. It's amazing. The character development on that show is the best I have seen since, whether you're a Breaking Bad fan or a Sopranos fan or a fan of The Shield. I think those three shows revolutionized the way the characters are presented on television. Any of those three shows, in my opinion, and I was a huge Sopranos fan, I think they pale in comparison to True Detective. Most fascinating show I've seen on television in years.
Two words you just said, character development. Let's go back to WWE. Man, you've got some young cats coming up in the program there, the Wyatts, three badass kids. And a couple of them have been around for a while. Luke Harper's been around a while. I don't know how long Eric Rowan's been around, but Bray Wyatt's coming into his own for the last year, has been doing so in the ring and on the mic. Also, you've got three badass cats with The Shield. Those guys, you got Antonio Cesaro. Did you work with Antonio Cesaro back in the day?
No, I would love to, though.
Okay, but anyway, he's another bright spot on the blip on the radar. So character development in the WWE. some of the gimmicks they've given to some of these guys has been a little lackadaisical at best. What are they doing over there to help these kids find an identity? And certainly the guys at Shield, guys in the Wyatts have done a tremendous job. Antonio Cesaro, he had a hell of a match with John Cena a couple of months ago. Premier talent, physical specimen, badass cat. I see money on him. Maybe not in the current gimmick, but there's money in that kid. So what are they doing to try to help these kids? What's the program now? Because in ECW, everybody that came through there, you helped really hone and define who people define, help them find their strong points and stay away from their weak points.
I think in ECW, we had the opportunity that I took myself as a director or writer or producer seriously to the point where my goal in that company was to take a Steve Austin who was misused by WCW, or a Mick Foley who was misused by WCW, or a Shane Douglas who never had a real opportunity to shine in a leadership role, and to produce and direct and refine and help those talents find themselves. You know, if you watch an Al Pacino or a Robert De Niro or a Harvey Keitel or a Dustin Hoffman, now, if they just work on a movie, they usually become caricatures of themselves. But once a Scorsese or a Coppola or a Milos Forman or a Sidney Lumet gets their hands on these performers, these directors will pull a performance out of these actors that they themselves never knew existed. So my ego in ECW was, hey, I want to be that guy. I want to find something inside this performer that no one else in this business has the wherewithal to pull that out of them and then show that performer, hey, you can do this on your own. Which is why to this day, now 19 years after you worked in ECW, you still bestow upon me all this praise. When all I really did was just say, hey, what's inside of you?
Right.
And once you tapped into it, you knew you didn't need me to bring it out of you. So what happens in WWE today, however, is that if you don't have the assertiveness and the wherewithal to find it yourself, then they don't think you have what it takes to stay a top guy. Could they plug you in to be a top guy? Absolutely. Jack Swagger was a top guy for a moment. Sheamus was a top guy for a moment. The Miz was a top guy. He main evented a WrestleMania, which is a sore spot with CM Punk. and he was a top guy for a moment, too. Whether they had what it took to then take those characters to the next level, to become a global persona and have box office and merchandise and licensing appeal on a global basis, obviously, at one point, Vince McMahon said, not this guy this time. The question that I would have to answer your question is, how much merchandising money did you make on Vince McMahon's vision of the Ringmaster?
Yeah, not too much.
And how much money did Vince McMahon make on your vision of Stone Cold Steve Austin? And that's the point. You had to come up with it yourself.
I had to come up with it myself. But is WWE creative doing everything that they can to get these cats pointed in the right direction? I think the training facility down in Florida is a great idea because all the territories are gone. There's no other place to really learn. Indies are getting picked. They're pretty thin anyway. And so looking for premier grade A people, I know now they're looking to, you know, recruit wrestlers, you know, from the Division I, II stuff and colleges, ex-football players from top college and pro programs with athletic ability and a look. Now, you got to put the rest of it into them, but they're starting with some good raw materials. But just from a character standpoint, are they doing all that they can? Are they open-minded enough? You know, take, for instance, when Damon Sandow came out, great name. I thought, you know, that everybody's kind of talking this guy up, and then he came out with pink trunks. You handed him an anvil right off the get-go, in my opinion.
But, you know this as well as I do. Sometimes they expect you to say, wait a minute, don't give me the pink trunks.
But my point is, people are on eggshells. People are too scared to say, I can't wear pink trunks.
Then shouldn't the criticism be on the talent that's on the eggshells and not on the people who sit there and say, hey, those who walk on eggshells are just going to be roster fillers. I'm looking for the guy that's going to say, No, don't put me in the pink tights. I'll take my beatings. And you know what? If you fire me, I'm going to go make money elsewhere, and you're going to have to pay me more money to come back.
Sometimes you got to make chicken salad out of chicken shit. I remember when I came in as a ringmaster. There I am in Atlanta, Georgia. Here comes Vince calling my phone. I'm starting to work with ECW, working with you. Hey, Steve, Vince McMahon. Hey, how you doing, pal? And I'd already talked to Vince two or three times. You know, I knew he had plans for me as a mechanic and a mechanic only, never to be a star. And he goes, yeah, listen, pal, I want to bring you in, call you the ringmaster. You know, the master of the ring. Put Ted DiBiase as your manager. You'll be the $1 million champion. Come in as a champion, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, I went to meet with Terry Anderson, the girls who do the wardrobe, and they wanted me in money green trunks. And I'm like, first they wanted me to wear a singlet. I said no to the singlet, but I had to give them something, so I acquiesced and said, okay, I'll wear the green trunks. I think I wore them for two TVs and said I'm going back to my black. You know, and then that's when I kind of started doing my own thing. The ringmaster sucked. 6 months later, I said, hey, man, not so much. Let's try this, Stone Cold. But anyway, so I just think that, man, just from a visual standpoint, that's not a striking image. Some cat and pig. It worked great for Bret Hart. I still see potential in this kid. Can he turn it around? Can he, dig inside his brain, his heart, and find something to make chicken salad out of chicken shit?
But you see, that's the same thing. Most guys today won't go even as far as saying, I won't wear the singlet.
Right.
That's it. See, that very first move you said was no. You just said, here you go, I said no to the singlet. And you said no to the singlet right there. Most guys don't have the balls to say no to the singlet. Right. Or then to say, okay, listen, I know you want me to wear green. I get the gimmick.
Right.
I'm going to wear the green tights, but I can't do it in a singlet. And now I'm 2 weeks into the green. Hey, I've tried it your way. It's not working for me. I want to go with the black. Most guys won't even get past the whole singlet thing.
Right.
And that's the thing. And what they're looking for is someone who has the assertiveness, the talent, and the ability. Like right now, you're looking straight into my eyes. And most people don't have that. And that's why they're roster fillers. It's the guys that sit there and say, okay, you can fire me. I'm going to go to Japan. I'm going to go to Mexico. I'll go to Ring of Honor. I'll go to Dragon Gate USA. I'll go on the indie circuit and make such a splash there. You'll have no choice but to hire me. But by the way, when I come back, it's going to cost you more money. And they sit there and go, who is this guy?
Right.
And someone in the back goes, you know who that guy is? That's our next top talent.
Right.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Paying out of your own pocket for gear you need to do your job is a problem. All kinds of departments across the nation, police, fire, EMS, medical workers on the front lines, and even military units, they all deal with constrained budgets and outdated gear. But there's still a job to do, and you need the gear to do it. Hunting for military first responder discounts has historically required going from one website to another and all kinds of hassle. Don't you wish there was one place you could visit that had a carefully crafted selection of deals for military first responders in one spot? GovX works directly with brands to negotiate the best prices possible because you deserve the gear you need at the prices you've earned. Plus, you can trust that the gear you're ordering is 100% authentic, direct from the manufacturer. If you must pay out of your own pocket, you shouldn't have to pay a premium to get the gear you need to effectively perform your duties and complete your mission. GovX has a huge collection of gear and apparel from popular brands, all in one convenient location. It's like a grown man's toy store in here. Just wait until you see our knife collection. All you need to do is sign up for free. No subscription fees. No re-upping your membership every year. Once you're approved, you're a fully fledged GovX member for life. GovX honors your service and gives back to your communities. We don't just thank you for your service, we honor it. So if you're an American of service, a current or former member of the military, firefighting, frontline medical, or law enforcement communities, or the emergency medical, join GovX for free and enjoy a community that honors and gives back to patriots like you. If you've got a military or first responder background, visit GovX.com and sign up for free for instant access to tons of deals and a community that honors your service. Visit GovX.com and receive $15 off first orders over $50 or more when you use code STEVE. That's $15 off first orders over $50 or more when you use code STEVE at GovX.com. Hey, down in ECW, when you guys were cutting those heavy promos, and I came along and uncorked at one, it was about 4:30 in the morning. Right. And, you know, all the other guys, because I was a new kid on the block, and all of a sudden came my time. I cut about a 7-minute promo with your direction. But the question is this. There were so many guys cutting such heavy-duty promos, from Raven to Cactus Jack to Shane Douglas to Sandman. I mean, it was just everybody had a damn good promo. Was there any, and I really love Shane Douglas's promos back in. Man, he was just bitter. I mean, he was just, he laid it all on the line. And, of course, you know, Mick would weave these promos with so many layers and levels and intricacies, and they were complex, and there were just so many stories and everything that he was saying. But I really enjoyed Shane Douglas's promos a whole lot there. And, of course, Raven was off the chart, too. Did you have a favorite promo back in the day, or a promo guy?
This is going to sound like a cop-out answer, but it really depended on the week. I was a huge fan of the Raven character.
Yeah, I was too.
And
the look.
Yes. Well, you know what else? It was something. Those who know Scott Levy,
yeah,
who is as childish and immature and ridiculous of a human being as you can ever meet in your life.
I traveled with him for a couple of years, true.
And
wonderful guy.
And here's a character that never smiled, he never broke character, and even when we put goofs around him like Stevie Richards and the Blue Meanie could be doing the most absurd things in the ring, and Raven would not even smirk.
Right.
He was so into that character. That Raven was the antithesis of Scott Levy. And then you take into account that everything the character Raven said was actually sympathetic. I come from a broken childhood. I come from a destitute family. I come from a drunken father. My mother beat the living crap out of me. I never had love as a child. All I seek is your love and your affirmation of the audience. And it's such a sympathetic character, but what he did with that character and the manner in which he delivered it and the actions that his character took to vent his frustration made him a heel. This guy was, at the time, I dare say in 1995, one of the best performers in the industry, not only on the mic, but I would say in the ring.
Right.
And yet, even that crowd, the smart Philadelphia crowd, the smartest, you know, the smarks, and, oh, these are the, you know, this is the smartest crowd in the industry, and nobody cheered him. He outsmarted them. You never heard a Raven chant. You never heard people pop for him. This guy played a heel, and he was such a heel and so great at it that no matter how sympathetic a story he told, you still hated his guts. And to me, that was it was so brilliant.
Yeah.
I was in awe of it. I liked Mick Foley's promos too.
Right.
When he started cutting those, I mean, that was just, there wasn't a lot of direction on that. That was just,
hey, it's kind of hard to direct at.
Yeah. You know, hey, what am I doing here? Okay, well, here's what we're selling. Okay, give me a few minutes, and he'd come back in and say he's ready. And I mean, here was my big direction: light him from underneath, shoot him from over top, and just go. And that was it.
Right.
With you, my job was real easy. With you, I talked to you on the phone. You know, what do you want me to say? You pissed off? Oh, I'm pissed off. Say you're pissed off. Who am I pissed off at? Bischoff. I could say that? Yeah, go ahead. Say it. So you come in, and you think I'm going to put you on first because we're buddies. And I said, you're next. And you go, okay. Pitbulls. I like these guys. They're cool cats. I'm going to watch them. Okay. Hey, can you watch the next guy too? Yeah, hell, why not? I got nothing else to do. And by the now, you go, hey, you know, it's 2:00 in the morning. Yeah, you're next.
It was 4:30.
that's the whole point. I made you wait, and you had the promo in your head because you spent half the week thinking about all you're going to say about Bischoff.
I didn't really know what I was going to say. It was a total shoot. I mean, from word go, there was really nothing mapped out. It was a one-take deal.
Right.
And it was all or nothing.
But that was the whole thing. My whole thing of producing you and directing you was to make you wait as long as I can make you wait, so that by the time we put you in front of that camera, you were so ramped and so amped and so competitive. Because I remembered that about you. I remembered you would never want to do promos before Rick Rude. You wanted to do promos after Rick Rude because he was so good.
Yeah.
And it gave you something to shoot for, gave you someone to compete with.
Right.
So, you know, and that also came from the time you were in the ring with Ricky Steamboat. because you knew all the great matches he had before, and you're like, well, okay, I want to be one of his favorite opponents because you knew he was going to be one of yours.
Right.
So I knew as long as the longer I made you wait, and we had Shane Douglas talk and this guy talk and that guy talk, the longer I made you wait, the better your promo was going to be.
Hey, did you ever see Meanie sent me Barbed Wire City, ECW. Did you see that DVD?
I honestly didn't.
Man, you got to see it. It just looked like a meat grinder. And there was just so much violence and stuff that was going on over there. And believe me, I remember the first night in. That was when Mick and Terry Funk were out there, and the steel chair had the flame on it, and it shot off, and you caught the dude up in the front row. It's like, Jesus Christ, I just got a job. I'm not going to have a job very long because they just burned up the guy in the front row.
Do you remember calling me that week, by the way?
Yeah.
Steve called me that week, and he goes, hey, are we going to be okay?
Well, I hadn't worked. I mean, I just got fired, and I was, you know, just had a family, a house on 10 acres, got to make the payments, you know, and it's not like I was going to get rich working with ECW, but it was a weekly paycheck, right. So I didn't want my weekly paycheck to disappear. But it was just, when you look back at that time, was it too violent? Was there anywhere for that promotion to keep growing? Because, I mean, everything but the kitchen sink was happening seemingly almost in every match, and certainly by the semi and the main event.
If I were to do a product today, there are many things that we did back in the 90s that there is absolutely no way to do today.
Right.
I mean, the first thing I'll tell you...
Because of PC or what?
Well, just on a conscious level, I would never allow a chair shot to the head again.
Right.
Never. Wouldn't do it. I don't care who you are.
But and we're speaking hindsight 2020.
Right.
Right.
We didn't know back then.
Right.
What the damage these chair shots to the head could do. And I mean, today I would never. I don't care if I owned my own promotion. I had billions of dollars in financing. Paul, you can do anything you want. I could not in good conscience allow a chair shot to the head. Today they're very squeamish about blood. I'm a fan of blood.
Same here.
I believe that blood is a part of the business, and I believe if done judiciously and right,
yes.
Even if it takes someone to take a hard way,
yes.
Blood is a major commodity in the business, all the way going back to the old school promoter saying red turns to green.
Right.
I do understand, though, the sensitivity to it, and that's part of the progression of the industry to be mainstream and global. If you want the United States military to be a sponsor, if you want Mattel to do your toys and not one of these doll makers, but you want the globally prestigious Mattel, these are the concessions that you have to make. Was it too violent for its time? I certainly didn't think so in 1995. I certainly didn't think so in 96 or even in 97. I tried to incorporate the Eddie Guerreros and the Dean Malenkos and the Chris Benoits and then the Rey Mysterios and the Juventud Guerreras and the Michinoko Pro guys.
And the Lance Storm.
Hey, Steve Austin, Shane Douglas, Taz. Yeah. You know, Taz wasn't a violent guy. The whole gimmick of Taz in being a UFC-style wrestler was... And his mantra, I don't need a weapon. My hands are my weapons.
Right.
Because to me, the whole thing was you can hit him with a chair, you can swing a barbed wire baseball bat, you can throw fire, you can hit him with the kitchen sink, you can stab him in the head with a pencil, you can put a staple gun up against his eardrum. At the end of the day, if he gets his hands on you, he's going to choke you out because he's a wrestler.
Right.
Now, if I had access to more of that style, I would have probably progressed the style based on the success of a Taz or even someone who I thought was always a hybrid version of the violence and the shoot style and the high flying, which was Rob Van Dam.
Right.
I thought Rob Van Dam, if you look back on ECW and you say to me, who's the one guy that defines the ECW brand? My answer would be Rob Van Dam.
Really?
Yeah. Because, well, besides the fact he wasn't a great talker, but his talk in ECW resonated with the audience because it was him. He was a genuine character. He talked about being stoned because he was.
Right.
And he talked about, hey, I'm Rob Van Dam. I'm the coolest dude out there, and this is the way it is, man. Then he'd do the double thumbs, Rob Van Dam.
Yeah.
So he wasn't a great talker, but he was effective for his role. But Rob could fly. Rob could wrestle. Rob could do strong style. Rob could do the chairs and everything else. In fact, his famous finishes were with chairs.
Right.
So I thought that he was the most hybrid style. He had evolved the style into something that was truly extreme, but not just bloodshed and mayhem.
Yeah, it wasn't violence for the sake of violence. You know, he was
correct.
Doing his, yeah.
If I could find people that could work, you know, I think the Sandman always had his place, even if it's just an entrance. It was the interaction. It was the, and I think New Jack had his place too. What a phenomenal talent. Jerome, I mean, one of the most underrated talents in the history of ECW is New Jack. Because he's one of the most phenomenal communicators I've ever met. That man could get on that mic and make you hate him or love him in an instant. And on television, hey, Jack, man, sell this match. All right, man, I'll sell this match. Now, he did it in his own way. But, man, he could sell. And you know, and his matches served a purpose. You know, that was your bloodletting. So, you know, if I had a more well-rounded crew.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. But still, it served its purpose, you know. You know, by the time we got past 1999, the crew was so depleted, I had to rely on profanity and violence because that's the crew I had left, because anybody else that had something to offer the more mainstream WWE or WCW was going to go for the millions of dollars, and I don't blame them for it.
Now, you've always cut a good promo, seemingly forever. Was there ever a time in your life that you didn't have the gift for gab? Because the point I'm trying to make is, before some of those matches, before some of those pay-per-views, I mean, you fired up the crew. You cut about a 10- or 15-minute promo. It was y'all against the world. And those guys went out there and did anything and everything to further that cause. Had they bought into the system? Well, obviously they did buy into the system. But, I mean, talk to me about those promos, because, I mean, you let those guys up and they would run through a wall.
Well, you know, they used to call it the Kool-Aid, you know. Right. Everybody would drink the Kool-Aid because, you know, I would fire them up. And, you know, and as you said, you know, they would run themselves through a wall. They would walk through fire for, you know, for me or for the company or for the cause. And I think it's because I believed in the cause. I mean, that wasn't a gimmick that I was playing. It wasn't a manipulation of the wrestlers. That I'm going to motivate these guys. Here's what I'm going to do today.
Yeah.
I'm going to motivate my talent by saying, let's go and let's make this happen. Let's show these guys, the ones who didn't hire you, the WWE that didn't have a vision for you, the WCW that's paying other people $250,000 signing bonuses to jump, and they're not giving it to you guys. Let's go show them how stupid they are not to notice you as individuals. Yes, that's exactly what I shall do. I shall give them that persona and light up my locker room. I believed it. First of all, I believed in my crew. There was nobody on that roster that I didn't truly believe in for the spot that they had. I truly believe the Sandman is one of the greatest characters we've ever stumbled upon. Do I think he's a great worker in the ring? Absolutely not. He's the drizzling shits and probably one of the worst workers of all time. But he was a money draw. Why? Because when that music played and he did that entrance, that audience was engaged and they were with him. They were all as one, and it was part of an experience of the 2.5 to 4 hours that we gave you a show. Same with New Jack, same with Rob Van Dam, same with Shane Douglas, Steve Austin, Mick Foley, Terry Funk, Tommy Dreamer, Joey Styles. From top to bottom, if you were there, I believed in you for a certain position. So the person that probably drank the most Kool-Aid in that locker room was me. Because whether I should have bought into it as a businessman or not, as a producer, director, writer, as a booker, as a cult leader, because it was in many ways a cult, and probably the most passionate member of the cult was me. I believed in it. I believed in the cause. And I so believed in the talent that I worked with that when I fired them up, it was because I was their biggest fan.
When you tried to, when you guys would take the show, because y'all produce this in your house, right?
And well,
in your basement.
The if you remember the cameraman, Ron Buffone.
Yeah.
Ron Buffone was partners with a guy named Charles Brazise. And Ron Buffone's parents had a house in pretty close to mine in Westchester County, New York. And Ron had converted his basement into a studio and converted a side room into the post-production facility. Now, you know, the funniest thing is, even to this day, people always say, "Hey, ECW was produced in a basement. And it was produced in somebody's mom's house."
That's what I heard.
Well, but here's the thing. Jay-Z and Beyonce. Mm-hmm. I mean, for, you know, the first couple of hip-hop.
Right.
Jay-Z is a $400 million man. He owned part of the Barclays Center. He owned part of the Brooklyn Nets. He has his own clothing line. He has this, he has that. Where does he produce his music now? In his own home. He converted his, he bought a $10 million home in Scarsdale, by the way. Changed the basement into a studio. Where does Dr. Dre produce his music? In his own home. Do you really think Eminem goes down Melrose Boulevard to a studio that Jimmy Iovine picks out for him? No. Eminem bought himself a huge estate. First thing he builds in his house, a production studio. So I'm not saying we had a multi-million dollar production studio, but if we're going to talk about being cutting edge and being the first of many, hey, we put it in the basement because we had access to a basement, and we put it in a side room because that's where we edited the show.
No, I know, but that was my point. But to go on that point, I mean, I do a little podcast. I don't like to leave my house, so if I can record myself at my house, I do. And with you just laying down three extreme cases of studios at a house, I'm fixing to build myself a studio at 316 Dimitri. It's going to be the cat's ass, and inspired here by a conversation with Paul Heyman, going back to that basement, putting that show together. Your vision for the music, or the, not vision, but your ear for the music, because I'm going back and I'm thinking, you know, like Thunder Kiss 65, I'm thinking Rob Zombie, the Nine, I don't know, Nine, what was that song?
Oh, my God.
Public Enemy.
Right.
You know, but just the music, the vibe, the energy. That show, because man, when I watch a show, I was hooked. I love
it. It's funny, I almost said Izzy Miyake, and that's the cologne that I'm wearing. It wasn't Izzy Miyake, and I really should know the name.
And you know what? The thing about it, I'm glad you're not wearing too much cologne. That's one of my pet peeves on the show, is people wear too much cologne. You know,
I read your tweet from the Delta Lounge.
Yeah, that's true. You're good because you're not offensive over here, and so it's the perfect level. But so, I mean, what were you thinking to go back to the music, the vibe and the energy of that show? Because man, when I started watching ECW, you know, first, you know, Eastern, and then you got involved Extreme, and it was just, man, it hit you. You felt it, and you didn't just watch it, but you felt it, and it was energy from top to bottom. So what were you thinking there?
Well, I was frustrated because I'd been fired from WCW, and then I sued them, and I got a nice large settlement, and I was actually out of the business. I was signed by the William Morris Agency in New York, an agent by the name of Jonathan Trumper. And they had a vision of going head-to-head with Howard Stern, who was at the time the end-all, be-all. And there was a hip-hop station in New York called Hot 97. And Hot 97 had made the commitment, we're going to go up against Howard Stern. So here's a smart-ass Jewish kid from Scarsdale, New York. And I was going to go head-to-head with Howard Stern starting that September. And I mean, the deal was cut. It was here we were going. I was out of the business. You know, it's funny that I say this now because it's 20 years later,
right?
But I was 21 now. I was burned out. I wanted out, and I had my fill, and I was done. I played Paulie Dangerously. I had a blast. Time to move on and do something else. And I'm on the phone with Jim Crockett, whose contract was expiring, his non-compete was expiring with WCW. And he said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm going to do radio. I'm going to get involved in something else, you know. And he said, don't you think the business needs a change? I said, yes. And I start rattling off, you know, I think we need to be more contemporary. These guys don't even know what hip-hop is. They have no sensation of what the audience is looking for today. I think you need more reality-based programming. I think you need characters that are more based on the actual. And I start running off what ended up being the ECW vision. And Crockett says, so you're just going to be one of these guys that bitch and moan and complain about it. And you're not going to do anything to change the system, because you can't change the system from the outside. You can only change it from the inside. He says, you know what? Maybe you should leave the business. The business has enough locker room lawyers as it is. Thank you, Mr. Luger. I appreciate your contributions. You sound just like Abdullah the Butcher. Bitch, 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 moan, moan, moan. But you won't do anything about it. And he hung up on me.
Straight up. That's a shoot.
Click. Right? Jim Crockett Jr., of all people. Right. I mean, really?
And he cut that promo on you.
Bitch slapped me.
Right.
Bitch slapped me. I'm like, wow. And I'm walking around all pissed off all day. Like, I'm gonna call him back and tell him he's right. He's right. I won't do anything. I'm just like everybody else. Bitch, I'm just a locker room lawyer. Why don't I do something about it? And Joey Styles tells this story better than I do because I told it to him back in the day. And, I had too much. I smoked way too much pot in the 1990s to really remember these stories accurately. But anyway, that day I was watching MTV. And the first video that came on after Beavis and Butthead, because I was a huge Beavis and Butthead fan because I was stoned, was LL Cool J's Mama Said Knock You Out.
Right.
And I watched it, and the angles and the way that they shot him in the fogged out arena with the old school microphone that dropped down like in the first Rocky movie or like in the Madison Square Garden days back when superstar Billy Graham was champion. And I just said, man, that's the vision. It doesn't have to just be matches, you know, and now here's your next enhancement match. You can put anything you want on the air if you cut it and you make it stylistic and you give it an edge and you give it a beat, that there's something that you can't take your eyes off. Because no matter how many times they re-aired that video that day, I watched it from beginning to end with my jaw open. I was like, wow, there's something fascinating about this. And I called Jim Crockett back and I said, I'm in. And he wanted to start what we were going to call the World Wrestling Network. Now, at the same time, I had to now disassociate myself with the deal from Hot 97 and piss off the William Morris agency. And now I'm saying, you know what? I'm going to go and I'm going to change the industry. Eddie Gilbert.
But so you were going to get into radio broadcasting.
Yes.
And you were going to go head to head with Howard Stern.
I was out.
And you just said, piss on it. I'm not going to do that. I'm getting back in the wrestling game.
And Jim Crockett talked me into it by bitch slapping me on the phone. That
God, day. But what, you know, what could have happened? Did you ever think about that? Had you done the radio thing?
See, I you know, it's funny. My father taught me a long time ago, if your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle. But she doesn't have balls, so she's not your uncle, so call her Aunt Roseanne.
Yeah. Don't even worry about what could have been.
I never deal with ifs. Because if we're going to deal with ifs.
But I'm just talking because I know you as a bright, sharp-minded guy with a quick, you know, wit and talk a mile a minute and make sense.
Right.
So I just think, yeah, you would have been damn good on the air.
Oh, I'd have kicked Howard Stern's ass.
Yeah.
And probably, you know, ended up with his deal on Sirius Satellite Radio with $100 million. And here I am doing WrestleMania 30, sitting up in your hotel room
doing
the Steve Austin podcast, which will now be broadcast from now on from your basement, like Jay-Z and Beyonce and like the old ECW TV shows.
Hallelujah. So back in the wrestling business.
So I was back in, you know, and then Eddie Gilbert was in Philadelphia. And back then, Eddie Gilbert and I were thick as thieves. You know, he was my brother. He was my mentor. He was my best friend. And he was in Philadelphia running Eastern Championship Wrestling with Todd Gordon. But it was falling apart because this was not the same Eddie that had contributed so much to the business.
Right.
This was the end of the line for Eddie, and he had lost himself in the narcotics that had taken over his life. So it was falling apart for Eddie bad, and Todd was desperate for somebody.
Was he that bad off?
Awful.
Yeah.
Awful. It wasn't him anymore.
Yeah.
A different human being. I mean, if you look at the creativity, I mean, we were in Alabama together in 1988 before I went to WCW, and we had a skeleton crew. And he was so magnificent as a booker. You know, I mean, we worked well together, but clearly I was his deputy. I was his assistant. I was his protege. Clearly, he knew what he was doing. He could find so much in so little. And yet, if he had a real good talent, oh, what he could do with them. And he popped that territory. I mean, truly popped that territory and fast.
And that would have been continental?
And lasted. Yeah, continental. Okay. I mean, he popped it fast and it lasted the entire summer.
Right.
And it was just brilliant, the stuff that he was coming up. Now, most of it, admittedly, was stuff that he watched that Lawler and Jarrett had booked in Memphis years before, but he put a new spin on it. I mean,
right.
Just as an example, because I'm a big believer in this. You know, so many people talk about one of their favorite ECW angles of all time was the Sandman angle when we blinded him and he stayed in his house for 4 weeks, and we've said, you know, he's gone, he's retiring, and he came out, and of course he revealed he wasn't really blind, and he beat the living dog crap out of Tommy Dreamer. Okay. And everybody, you know, and it's funny because, you know, this is one of you, oh, what a genius thing, Paul Ball. Did you see how Heyman booked that? Okay. Here's why it's not that much genius. Do you remember the old Southern angle where a guy would come out with a broken arm? I broke my arm last night in Oakenfield, Kentucky, and I can't wrestle Jerry Lawler or Bill Dundee or Robert Fuller, whoever the babyface was, and my arm is broken. I'm going to get you next week when this cast comes off my arm. And, of course, the babyface comes down and goes, well, I'll fight your man, whoever you're old. Here's my man right now. And it'd be, you know, some big, fat, 400-pound guy behind him. And when the babyface turns around, out comes the arm. Whoa, bam, down. Grows the baby face, right? Yeah. And you gave it away in 5 minutes of television.
Right.
Same thing that we did with the Sandman. We quote-unquote blinded him. He played blind, but we didn't do it for one day. We didn't do it for 5 minutes. We did it for 4 or 5 weeks, and we milked it out to where it got the most possible impact. It was just an updated version of one of the oldest angles in the business.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Hey, I want to tell you guys about Cushy Dreams. Cushy Dreams offers a full lineup of premium smokable CBD. They specialize in extraordinary CBD-rich hemp flower, a.k.a. bud, in cans and pre-roll CBD joints. Enjoy all of the health benefits of CBD without getting high, under 0.3 THC. It's cannabis that ships directly to you, and it's legal in all 50 states. Join the men and women who are sick of vapes and gummies and want to smoke their CBD. Smoke your CBD. Looks like high-quality marijuana, feels like high-quality marijuana, and tastes like high-quality marijuana. Independent lab tests to show compliance and purity are posted on their website. Grown in the USA, Cushy Dreams has CBD flower in and pre-rolls. They come in specific indica, sativa blends like Energy, Hustle, Relax, and Dream. My producer, Sean, says he likes to smoke the relaxed strain before bed to get some shut-eye after editing the podcast. He says it tastes great, exactly like high-quality weed. He would know. And, hey, it can be really helpful for these anxious times of 2020. Go to CushyDreams.com, K-U-S-H-Y. Get some high-quality CBD bud. At checkout, use promo code Steve for 20% off every order. Cushy Dreams. Smoke your CBD.
The Steve Austin Show.
The Steve Austin Show.
Paul Dangerously. Paulie Heyman. It's Paul Dangerously. But you grew up your whole life in New York.
Yes.
So how, when you, all of a sudden, you got the wrestling bug. No, you were taking pictures.
Yes.
You were a photographer. But how'd you end up getting your first managing gig down in the South?
Well, I actually started in the Northeast, and Kevin Sullivan had come up for a show. And, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Right.
And I knew Kevin from when I was a photographer, because I had put him and Nancy on the cover of a few wrestling magazines. And so Kevin knew me. And the funniest thing was, the month before I started as a manager, I was actually down in Florida taking pictures for all the magazines. And I was joking around with Humperdinck. And Humperdinck going, brother, you should do this on television, brother. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to do this on television. I really had no ambition to actually perform.
Come on.
I didn't really think I could have done it. I really, you know, to make it, you have to make it to Madison Square. You know, to me, the end all be all would be to Madison
Square
Garden.
What was it about the business that you just latched on to from your earliest memories?
The larger than life personalities. Once I saw superstar Billy Graham on television that first time, talking about Bruno Sammartino and the spaghetti, you know, I'm going to come on there, I'm going to take the spaghetti, I'm going to take the spaghetti, because I won't just take the food off the man's plate, I'm going to take the spaghetti off the man's plate, I'm going to wrap it around my 22-inch biceps so that the vascularity comes out on the superstar, on the microwave system beamed across the galaxy, well, they all can just admire the superstar. And I just went, I want to be him. I want to talk for a living. I don't want to punch a clock. I want to go on TV and just talk.
Yeah.
And that was it. I was like, my God, this is just the larger than life personalities that just could come through the TV set.
So then you talk with Humperdinck. He says you got to get in. You do what?
I didn't believe
and you
him.
You got hooked up with Kevin.
Well, what happened was I was taking pictures at the Monster Factory Larry Sharp School, yeah, that he actually inherited from Buddy Rogers. And one, I had already promoted a few events. I promoted Bam Bam Bigelow's first match in 1985 when I was 19 years old at Studio 54. So, I mean, I'd been involved, and I also wrote a bunch of the TV shows behind the scenes for a lot of the North, because back, you know, understand, 1985 was when WrestleMania debuted, and this was the explosion of cable in the country.
Right.
So there were every single town, you know, Cox Cable would have its own stations in different towns. So San Antonio would have Cox Cable 10, and then Austin would have Cox Cable 12. And these are all different TV stations, and not just local access. These are actual TV stations because it's now cable is expanding. One of them, Channel 17 out of Atlanta, became a superstation, right, which became everybody's goal. There were 20 to 25 promotions in the Northeast in 1985. So I was doing play-by-play for half of them, and I was god-awful because I had no idea what I was doing yet. But I was also writing some of their TV shows. Because I would write their programs and say, listen, I'll tell you what, I'll let you sell the programs. You can even keep the money if you cover my cost. But can I write this TV show? Because I like to do that. I like to play around with the right personalities. So I'd already had experience writing the TV shows. And Bigelow had already gone to Memphis and Texas. And he had already started touring. And he already had, I don't know if he had a Japan tour yet, but I think he had at least one. And Studio 54 had folded because of the big insurance crisis in 1986. And I was out of work except for the wrestling magazines, and I was looking for something else to do. And Bigelow said, hey, man, why don't, dude, you know, you should just talk your shit on television. I was like, ah, oh, man, I could never do that. You know, you gotta play the, if you're going to be anybody, you got to be, like you would say, if you're not here to win the title, you're just spinning your wheels, man. You're wasting your time. If I wasn't going to make it to the Garden, if I wasn't going to be the heir apparent to Fred Blassie and Lou Albano and the Grand Wizard, I didn't want to do it. I wanted to be the biggest one in the business or not be the guy at all.
Right.
But I also had a desire to write and produce and direct, which, you know, they call booking back then. Man, I really wanted to be a booker, but there was no way I was going to ever get to be a booker if I didn't get in the door. And I figured a way in the door was to be this Paulie Dangerously schmuck, talk on television, get in with the promoters and go, hey, could I write your TV show? So I took him up on it. So I started doing it in the Northeast. And on like my second or third show, Kevin Sullivan was there. So when we're doing this interview, I'm with my guys, the Motor City Men, who were two students from Larry Sharp's school. And I did an interview, and because Kevin was there, I decided I threw in a couple of references to some guys from the past that he would identify with, like Blackjack Mulligan and Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair and, you know, and the Asiatic Spike and Mark Lewin. And by the time I was done, he goes, brother, would you like to do this in Florida? And I, absolutely, I'd like to do this in Florida. And by the way, who writes your TV show? You know? So the next thing you know, I was booked in Florida.
So how'd you come up with the name Paulie Dangerously?
When I was younger and skinnier and had some hair, I looked like Michael Keaton, who had done a movie called Johnny Dangerously.
Yeah.
And I liked the name. I just thought, okay, what name can you use?
Because who would ever remember the name Paul Heyman? I can't go out there and say, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman. How could that ever get over?
Yeah. So I was just looking for, you know, it was the age of gimmicky names too. And I was looking for a name, and I looked so much like Michael Keaton back then. I just said, you know what, Paulie Dangerously, and it was a catchy little name that, you know, it was a, you know, and it was a schmucky name too. So
that wait, you know, that, but that's the line in the sand. It's either schmucky because it doesn't get over, or it's really cool if it does get over. It is what it is. It's just if you get it over or not.
You know, if I never accomplish anything else in this industry, I can honestly go around and say to myself, I'm the guy that got Stone Cold Steve Austin to use the word schmucky.
Schmucky.
I know, you know, you got to get a call from Jim Ross. Did you actually go on air and say schmucky with Heyman?
So the telephone, the big ass goofy cell phone. The idea for that.
Freddie Blassie used to have a cane.
Right.
And when I used to ride with Freddie Blassie when I was 15 years old, he always used to say, get a prop, kid. Get a gimmick. Hit somebody over the head with it, and you'll make a ton of money. The pencil neck geeks, they never saw it coming. So, you know, so I broke in, and I realized there's nobody that's doing something that taps into the modern day – Everybody, most of the managers that I saw were doing things that were harkening back to the 60s and the 70s, and I was already in the late 80s. And the movie Wall Street was very popular, yeah. And Gordon Gekko had that big cell phone. Yeah. And I remember saying, you know, you take a cell phone like that to crack somebody over the head. It's a great way to get heat, or you get color, or it's the finish of the match.
Or it also looked like a hot shot thing to have because no one had one.
Exactly. So it fit the Wall Street yuppie character. And it was so obnoxious to walk around with his big phone in the middle of a match. And I'm, who is he talking to? Who? They're not really talking to anybody. Hey, screw you. So it was a heat getter and it was a weapon.
Okay, so when you look back at all the greatest managers, who in your mind do you really still look up to? Because I would put you in, among the top of all time. With everything that now that you've accomplished. So you're up there.
Well, thank you.
You've done, or in my mind, accomplished an astronomical amount in your career. But in your mind, who are the greatest managers of all time?
I mean, I don't think you can have that conversation without Bobby Heenan.
Oh, Bobby, Jesus Christ. I mean, that guy could work his ass off. He could work better than most of the boys.
Yes.
Timing impeccable. Just incredible.
And could fill any role.
Any role. Where you could love him, you could hate him, you could make you laugh, and as soon as you got finished, make you laugh, make you hate him again. The stuff that he did back and forth with Gorilla was just absolutely priceless.
Amazing. It's just an amazing talent. And it's a shame that Bobby Heenan never did something outside of the industry like Saturday Night Live, because he was so qualified for something like that.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of Lou Albano in terms of someone who could generate a lot of heat. And I don't mean to speak ill of somebody, especially if they're gone, but if you watch what he did when then the babyfaces got their hands on him, I kind of resent it now. Because I know the beating that I take when it's time for the babyface to blow it off. I mean, just what Punk and I did last year, and just the, you know, with the kendo stick, he beat the living crap out of me every single night, and needed to, and people needed to see that I was legitimately getting my ass kicked because that's what they paid to see.
Right.
And Albano would just, like, you know, the famous match that he had with Snuka in the Garden, and please, anybody watching this, go on YouTube and YouTube Lou Albano, comma Jimmy Snuka, comma Madison Square Garden, and I'm sure the WWE lawyers will have this taken down. So do it fast. Snuka comes in the ring. He hits Albano, who just shakes, literally takes the tape off his wrist, takes the blade, runs it across his forehead as blatant as if, you know, the old Memphis thing where, you know, you hold open your tights and you put your hand down your pants.
To get the chain up. You know,
you wrap the chain around your hand so that the guy in the highest cheap seat can see it.
Yeah.
That's what he did with the blade.
Yeah.
And then he feeds back to Snuka, who hits him. And Albano just goes, And then he takes out the blade again and just goes, and zippers himself and takes two bumps in the match. And then takes a splash and rolls out and does the Albano walk back to the dressing room. Again, you ask me who the best is. I think Albano was great at what he does, what he did. The heat that he drew was just amazing to me back in the day. I wish he would have put the baby faces over more when it was time. Because when Bobby Heenan put the baby faces over, my God, that man could take an ass kicking.
He could take an ass whooping, he had egg on his face, he could be embarrassed, humiliated, and he gave it all back.
So, you know, I look at those two, you know, just as being the best of all time. I mean, there are certainly, I mean, listen, I think J.J. Dillon played his role fantastically.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't like J.J. when I worked in WCW because I realized how hard I was working compared to how hard he was working. But now that I'm older and I just stand at the desk and then I raise an eyebrow or I just take one step. Oh, Heyman has moved one step closer to the ring. I kind of appreciate what the old man was doing. Cornette was great.
Yeah.
And great to work with, too.
Yeah. The thing that always got me about Jim Cornette was, I mean, one of my favorites of all time. And, of course, Midnight Express, one of my favorite tag teams of all time. But, Jesus Christ, he could run his mouth for 20, 30 minutes just nonstop. I mean, forget about it. and forever.
Well, he was a protege of Jimmy Hart.
Yeah.
And that's another great
one.
Again, but these are all managers of different styles. I'm not saying that these are the styles. I could never do what Jimmy Hart did. I could never do what Jim Cornette did. I couldn't take bumps like Bobby Heenan could take. Right. I can get my ass kicked pretty well, but I have to legitimately get my ass kicked to do it. And Lou Albano was Lou Albano, and I would be remiss not to say Freddie Blassie, because my God, he knew box office. Freddie understood, the key lines to say on the go home week. And Ernie Roth, the Grand Wizard, was probably one of the most brilliant strategic managers. I don't mean by giving, I want you to go in the ring and hit him with a left and a right. And I don't mean that. I mean just strategic in terms of his interviews and hitting the key selling points, the right weeks to sell the tickets.
Right.
And he was brilliant. I learned a lot from him, too.
How was he just as a guy behind the stage? I mean, because I just saw, I knew of the Grand Wizard, watching him with the superstar.
Very interesting, because everything, he had a booker's mentality. So everything was about how to book something. It was never about, hey, this guy needs to do this or this guy needs to do that. It was always about the long range. What's the vision for this guy? Where are they going with him? If you put too much sympathy on this guy, then when the time comes and you really need to beat him down, they've already seen him sell. Or, you know what? That heel is peaking too quickly, and they're going to want to blow the steam off of him now instead of letting him build for 6 or 7 months and then giving him to Backlund or whomever was the – or, Sergeant Slaughter or Jimmy Snuka or Pat Patterson at the time. So he always had a booker's mentality. Where's not only today's box office, what's the long-range box office? Because he worked for the Sheik.
Right.
And there's a guy that had more longevity than almost anybody in a territory. So you always had, and you look at the Sheik and Bobo Brazil and Pampero Furpo and the guys that drew money long time in Detroit. And that's how Ernie learned it. So when Ernie was teaching somebody, he was teaching you not just quick fixes and momentary business. What's the long range vision here?
Right. Anybody else? I got to put Paul Ellering in there. I thought he was a perfect fit with the Road Warriors. I liked what he did. And going back to your point about J.J. Dillon, I thought he was perfect with the Four Horsemen.
I can't deny that. I mean, whether they stand out as my favorites, I can't say that they
do. No. Yeah, you know, his favorites.
But, I understand. Listen, they were very good in their roles,
yeah.
and they certainly played it very well. I mean, but you can say the same thing about a lot. I mean, there was Sir Oliver Humperdinck. There was Sir Dudley Clements. There was Eddie Creechman. I mean, all these guys. There was, back in the day with Buddy Rogers. Who looked better than Bobby Davis as a manager? I mean, my God, the guy was the perfect manager with Buddy Rogers. There were guys that filled that role, but Bobby Heenan could work with anybody.
Oh, absolutely. I put Bobby Heenan probably as number one. Promos. You just did a great superstar Billy Graham on the go. Superstar was ahead of his time.
Yes.
Dusty Rhodes, I loved his promos. Who are some of your favorite promo guests?
Back in those days or just of all time?
Any day.
This is going to sound like I'm kissing your ass, but obviously Stone Cold Steve Austin. Ravishing Rick Rude. And the funniest thing was I never liked his promos on television, but I love them live. I always thought that Rude was a live event promo guy and never truly mastered the art of doing promos on television, because he was so big and he broadcasted so wide that he was a live event guy more than he was a television guy. I like Jake Roberts' promos as a heel, very much so. Having worked with him since I've been back, I love CM Punk's promos.
Yep.
I don't think you can ever list best promo guys and not mention The Rock.
Right.
I don't think you can mention best promo guys and not mention Vince McMahon during his run with you.
Right.
Those were some killer promos that drew all the heat that you as a babyface needed to rebel against.
Right.
He wasn't my style, but Hogan drew a lot of money talking.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that. I mean, people bought into that act, hook, line, and sinker.
If I asked you today who the greatest in-ring worker was of all time, I think you'd tell me Ric Flair.
Well, I mean, he's my favorite pro wrestler. When I look at just straight-up performers, Shawn Michaels.
I feel the same way. Yeah. I think Shawn Michaels was a far more well-rounded, bigger box office, better in-ring worker than Ric Flair. But my God,
yeah.
Ric Flair would talk and make you believe he was,
the he best thing going today.
It. I mean, you know, and he was the whole thing, and it was 24/7, 365 with that guy. And Shawn Michaels, the thing, his favorite pro wrestler is Ric Flair as well. So I'm in good company.
Yes.
But when I look at the best in-ring performer night in, night out, just on athleticism, story, psychology, the whole ball of wax, Shawn Michaels is to me is number one.
See, and it's funny. I think there's something else. I don't think Jerry Lawler ever gets enough credit.
Never.
For the money that he drew in Memphis and how he talked them into the building.
And you got to include him on your all-time promo list just because, I mean, he could tell a story. I mean, all you got to do is just Lance Russell hand him a damn microphone or just lead him in. He doesn't even have to lead him in. He'll start telling a story. And then what I always loved about Lawler's work, whether it was either a promo or in the ring, with intensity. You know, a lot of guys think, okay, man, we've been feuding like a sumbitch for all this long, and we just got to jump it. Lawler could still just go out there and lock up with the guy and tell the story from Jump Street and not, you know, from A and then end up at Z by the end of the match.
Yes.
In a rage, pulling the strap down, double color, you know, and it was a blow-off. You didn't have to start, you know, at 6,000 RPMs. And he did that whether he was talking or whether he was working. And that's why I have so much respect for Jerry the King Lawler. Yes, he was one of the best promos. And people think just because he wasn't running his mouth a mile a minute or saying catchphrases that they didn't, you know, maybe didn't catch on to what he was doing. But make no bones about it. Lawler's one of my favorites of all time, talking or working.
I'll tell you, somebody else was Austin Idol.
I was watching a lot of Austin Idol the other day because I know we used to ride together.
Yes.
And, you know, Rude was in the car. And I'd be saying GD too much, and he'd get mad. Or, Steve, must you use the Lord's name in vain while he's rolling the joint back there? But I was watching some Austin Idol the other day to try to dig into some of his stuff. Sometimes I wanted his cadence to speed up a little bit for me, but he was very deliberate and articulate in what he said and had a certain confidence level.
He was the first star I managed, and I managed him in Memphis when I was 21 years old.
Right.
And, you know, just the way, brother, you know, he would come on the ring, and he would scream, and he'd yell. And, I mean, he would yell at the top of his lungs, but he would enunciate the
right
words. Because most guys that yell, and I was very guilty of this in my younger days, when you yell, people can't understand everything that you're saying because you're yelling and you have the tendency, but you're yelling and talking so fast, and you're talking so fast that they lose the meaning of the words that you're saying.
Right.
And because you're emphasizing every word, none of them really stick out.
Right.
The genius of Austin Idol was that he could yell and still hit the points, articulate and enunciate the words to such a degree that you understood everything that he was saying. I was fascinated. When I would work with him, we would do promos, and I'd catch myself staring at him just because I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, this guy's really good. I hope I'm this good one day. You know, and you catch yourself doing it.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
You own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
Oh, by the way, you know, and I'm happy to answer that. I'll tell you something, and this is going to sound like hype, but I have to give somebody credit for, I think, being one of the best all-time in-ring workers, but he's never, more than 2 years of his life, never worked a full schedule.
Who's that?
Brock Lesnar. Tell me somebody more believable than his work.
Nobody.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The man is amazing. And again, I know this is going to sound, oh, of course he's going to say Brock. One, oh, it's his buddy. Or two, he works with Brock Lesnar and he's hyping his own guy. But I mean this sincerely. I've always thought this about Brock. Man, 6'3", he's 295 pounds. And sometimes he's over 300 pounds.
Yeah.
He can do anything he wants in the ring. His selling is amazing. His offense is quite believable. And everything he does looks right for him. He's not one of these big muscle guys that stand in the ring and you have to bounce off. He can bounce off of you.
Yeah.
And what he does looks credible. So and just and he understands his character, and he understands what he should and shouldn't do. So just in terms of being an all-around in-ring performer, I'm always captivated by watching him. And I don't just say that because...
Well, here's the thing. Let me cut you off. I don't even think the guy scratched the surface yet. Because I'm a big Brock Lesnar fan. I knew when he walked in the door, I just did a deal for UFC Fight Pass a couple of days ago. They were doing a special on Brock. And I remember when Brock walked in, it's just like I said on the interview, it's like you might as well have a bolt on each side of his neck. It's just Frankenstein of a human being walks in the door, and all of a sudden everybody goes, this dude over there, everybody knew he was going to be something. And that doesn't usually happen. Because everybody knew that he had a Division I or whatever background, All-American. So they knew he could go. And then all of a sudden you see this look. You can't just manufacture that look. You're born with it.
Right.
And, you know, the dude is just badass. And so he's got all these skills, and all of a sudden, you know, he learned the pro game, you know, from his amateur background. And then, you know, maybe the travel schedule, whatever, a little hectic. He, goes to play football. Had Brock Lesnar started off with a background in football and had technique, he'd be playing in the NFL right now. But he's going against guys who played football all their lives and had leverage on him.
Well, also, when he went to the Vikings camp,
yeah,
he was the last guy to get cut. And when he got cut, he had that motorcycle accident. He actually did that entire camp with a broken jaw and a broken pelvis.
I didn't know that.
Because he doesn't give excuses.
Yeah.
He's not an excuses type of guy.
Well, no. I mean, you know, he's a freak of nature. And I mean that with that's about as good a compliment as I can give anybody. So anyway, so then he goes to UFC, leaning on his amateur wrestling background and not really a technically proficient striker. And what does he do? Turns into the world heavyweight champion in an octagon and beats some of the baddest cats in the program at the time.
Including Randy Couture, who's arguably the greatest heavyweight of all time.
Frank Mir, one of the greatest heavyweight submission guys in the game. And then, you know, his issues with diverticulitis. I mean, who knows, you know, how he would have really performed if he hadn't had those issues going against him. Now he comes back to the squared circle. And so really, he's still a young guy in life because he's probably 34, 35 years in the business. He's still a young guy because he's got so much more. I mean, however long he wants to wrestle, he will, because that's the type of physical specimen that he is. I don't think that we've seen the best of Brock Lesnar yet. I don't.
I agree with you. I agree with you, and I'm glad someone else feels that way. It doesn't just think I'm flapping my gums about my friend or the guy that I'm paired
yeah,
with.
So I mean, but if he were to get on a full time schedule, I don't know what his deal is.
Well, that ain't gonna happen.
Well, I know, but I mean, we're texting each other because I'm looking forward to seeing when he comes in a couple of days. But I mean, were he to just get on the road and go full tilt, who knows what you would see out of the guy? I just think he would just redefine what is going on in the squared circle right now. And because he's a dominant specimen, he understands the game. And if he had, you know the deal, Paul. Let me quit stuttering. Everything is on the job training, and you get into a rhythm. And once you get into that rhythm, and all of a sudden, all the creative juices start flowing, and it's just not a gig here, there, and you know, and wherever on a yearly contract. There's no telling what the guy could do if he got on the road.
I think he's in the mode now of the super fight. And I think,
and that's a great mode to be in. I'm just saying what could be if he were to get on the road. Before I, you know, let you talk again. Yeah, man, the way he's booked right now, that's a cat's meow.
Yes,
I love his gig.
It's a great gig, and you know, and not to put you on the spot, but can you imagine the baddest dude on the planet versus the toughest SOB in WWE history? Because I mean, when we were in UFC. And we were always thinking, well, do you think we're ever going to go back to WWE? I mean, ever, you know, to me that, you know, and when you came to his match, which was the match with Carwin.
Right.
You know, that, and I even said it to you then. I was like, man, that's just the ticket. You know, I mean, just to me, I don't know who could tempt you to ever come back. I don't, you know, I really don't. Because not only does it have to be the right box office, it has to be the right opponent, has to be the right creative, it has to be someone that can push you physically to deliver the same type of performance that people remember you giving them in the late 1990s when you were absolutely untouchable inside the ring. So it has to be someone that can give you that match. Have to be someone that can give you the right venom for your promos. Has to be the right creative. Has to be the right physicality. And obviously, has to be the right box office. To me, I look at, okay, who would Steve Austin come back against? The one guy that I look at is Brock Lesnar. And I say that from a selfish basis, knowing that some point in that push, I'd be eating a stunner and be covered in beer that you would douse me with as you're saying, I got your bitch right here. Come and get him and pick him up.
And no doubt a bunch of knuckle sandwiches.
Oh, I'm sure there would be.
Hey, before we wrap this whole thing up.
I like how you completely changed the subject on that one.
No.
Well, that's a conversation Vince and I need to have one day. And
well, watch. I'll push the stop button, and then I'll push the restart button again. Okay, we're recording again. That could happen. that would be how I could accomplish that.
Your Honor, may we go off the record?
So that would be something that I'd be interested in entertaining. But anyway, so now here we are.
Oh, you just sold this podcast. Austin admits he's tempted by Lesnar.
Well, you heard it here first on the Steve Austin Show. I haven't had a Bloody Mary yet. Hey.
Is it Lesnar's move now to say, I wouldn't want to fight that guy. He's doing podcasts.
Well, it's another machine to promote the match. All hands on deck, Paul. All hands on deck.
All screens, all platforms.
Hey, before we wrap this thing up, I got one bar strength of battery left on my meter. We had some damn good times traveling down the road with Ravish and Rick Rude. You know, one of the funnest things I loved about traveling with you guys was just sitting around and talking about the business. And because, you know, when Rick Rude started talking, and as good of a mind as you have for the business, he was so clear in his vision and how he broke the business down. It was very ABC. And it was very simple for him.
Yes.
And
yes.
He loved booking, and he just loved talking about, you know, what we needed to do next, or he needed to do next, or what the crowd was doing, or he loved playing chess or playing checkers, whatever the game was.
He simplified it.
Yeah.
You know, Rick, how do you see this? I see it very simple. Black hat, white hat. What about it? Don't you see?
Yeah.
And that was it. He simplified the entire situation with that. There's a good guy. There's a bad guy. The bad guy has to have enough heat that a credible good guy comes to kick his ass, and the people pay to see it.
But it was fun times.
I had a blast,
man. We used to roll into Kansas City. We always stayed at the Marriott there, and we'd be playing pool. And I don't know what Rick was doing. I know he'd had a couple of beers. He wasn't so much of a heavy drinker, but there I was, and me and him always were partners, and because we didn't need any animosity in the car. And there would be Rick standing there, and I'm sitting here, and I've got this, you know, like both hands vertically hanging onto the pool cue, and he'd be standing there, and that pool cue would be like the third pod, and so he would just be standing there, sleep, standing up, and it would be his shot. And I missed a shot, and the other person missed a shot, and we was all drunk. And so I'd have to go wake up Rick while he was standing here holding this pool cue. It's like, Rick, it's your shot. Hey, what are you going to do, a shot? One time, I think it was in Philly. It was a late night. I didn't have any money. Just came to WWF. I'm hanging out with Rick Rude. And was it WCW or WWF? It had to be WWF. It had to be WCW because that was the only time we were together.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, so anyway, we're WCW. Late night, about 2 or 3 in the morning, me and Rick decided to split a room. All times we traveled together, you know, I always stayed by myself. Or
right, you would stay at the we'd stay at the Marriott, and yeah. You would always be at the Motel 6. You go, Steve, you have to upgrade a little. And you're like, I'm just a simple man, Rick. I like a Sonic hamburger. I like me a beer, and I like me my Motel 6. They'll leave the light on for you.
That one time I spent a night with Rick Rude and pretty hammered, and Rick was over snoring like a freight train. I mean, I cannot tell you how loud he was snoring, and I was over madder than a hornet because I don't sleep very well anyway, and he'd be over snoring, and I'd go, Rick! Rick! And he'd roll over, and 5 minutes later he'd start over, Rick! Rick! You know, 5 minutes. And I'm getting madder and madder and madder. But what are you going to do? Wake up Rick Rude? I mean, he was a badass dude anyway. And he's a senior guy. He's a veteran in the business. And just start going, dude, shut up. I cannot sleep. I'm the rookie in the room. So I'm trying to show him respect. So anyway, point is, I didn't sleep an ounce that night. And from that night on, I never roomed with another human being because I didn't want to listen to a sumbitch snore.
But he could scale a catfish with the best of them, couldn't he?
Oh, dude, don't even get me on that catfish story.
Go ahead, tell it.
Oh, I told the story the other day. It was down there at the hunting camp in Georgia. He caught about 20 catfish. I caught about two. I'm out there in a trash can with a pair of pliers skinning catfish. Someone had brought a damn easy chair and a big screen, a color TV and one of those top-load VHS players. He's in there smoking a big fat joint. Rick loved to smoke dope. I wish that guy was still around. He's so funny. And then all of a sudden he walks out. Someone brought Cape Fear. He's in there watching Robert De Niro in Cape Fear. And he comes out and he goes,
The screen door slams. What are you doing? Rick, I'm cleaning all these catfish. I said, do you want to help me clean them? Nope. And walks back in and sits on the easy chair and starts watching Cape Fear again.
Man of very few words. He simplified the situation and he articulated his answer perfectly.
Hey, man, so many of the damn boys, I want to end this thing on a bad note. Man, so many of the damn guys have left this damn world too soon. I reach out and every now and then I'll call someone out of the blue, check in on how they're doing. It's just, it's a rough life, but guys got to take care of themselves.
Yes. Yes, the travel in and of itself, the demands of the travel are just brutal. They will age you so much.
Yeah, I don't want to get on a big tangent, but all you guys out there and the guys that got out of business, man, chill back on your stuff. It's time to go back into a civilian life. Hell, I did. I'm trying to live on this goddamn ball of rock we call Earth for as long as I can. Another 15, 20, 30 years would be good.
Well, don't limit yourself.
Wait, man, come on, man. I'm 49. If I get 30 years, yeah, I'm good.
Okay.
That'll be time to get the deal in.
I don't want to check out that early. I'd like to hang around a little longer.
You're not going
to
be the guy in a nursing home with a guy, you know, like, okay, Paul, we're going to, Mr. Heyman, you know, because he's 20 or she's 20, we're going to change your diaper.
You know, hey, what are we going to do with Pop? You know, my children sitting there, could you put Dad in the garage today? I have friends coming over, you know. And they wheel me into the garage. And, like, you know, that's what my kids will end up doing with
what
me.
What does Pop want to do today? Oh, he said he wanted to watch his ECW DVD highlight reel again.
I don't want, you know, the funny, because he asked me about the barbed wire city. I don't watch anything old. I really don't.
Yeah,
I don't. I don't wax nostalgic. I just, you know, I learned that from being a kid. You know, my mother was a Holocaust survivor. So I mean, gee, wow. I you know, it was always about moving forward into the future. You can't really hang on to the past. You can't live in the past. So I just my kids watch it.
Right.
But, you know, and I meant it sincerely. I try to take away all the YouTube stuff that they to watch, just because I was like, that's not daddy anymore. Yeah. You know, let them watch now. And yeah. And I never watch the past. And of course, that's how you'll know I'm old and senile. Hey, that was me. And there I am right there.
All right, we're going to wrap up this edition of Steve Austin Show. I rounded up Paulie down there in the green room. He came up here. I don't have one single note. Didn't look in a computer. Called it in the ring.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate you coming by the room.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure. Can we get room service now?
Man, that brings my interview with Paul Heyman to a close, folks. But get ready, because part two is coming Thursday. Thing about it was, hell, I pushed the stop button. It was time to stop the interview. Paul E. just sat there, and we kept talking and talking and talking. So I said, well, hey, man, what if I just fire up the record button and start recording again? So we did. We're going to get to part two of my conversation with Paul E. Dangerously, a.k.a. Paul Heyman, this coming Thursday. It's great to sit down with an old friend. And, you know, again, just kind of calling in the ring. There's a lot of things that after I had the conversation with Paul, I wished I would have asked. But I didn't know who I was going to come across, because it was WrestleMania 30 weekend. And I knew who I wanted to talk to, but didn't know if I was going to get to talk to him. So I wasn't going to do a bunch of research prior to going into the situation and not be able to get a hold of the people I wanted to talk to. So believe me. All the people I talked to were great people. I just love to do my research. You're going to get some more Paul Heyman coming up this Thursday as I wrap up part two.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
New to Podcast One Sportsnet, Michael Irvin and Ron Jaworski.
The MIP. I am the MVP of the MIP. I am Michael Irvin, and I got a great show.
It was a shock. It was a shock to the system.
I went to practice the next day. I made every tackle.
No big deal. Any other coach out here, you lose, you will leave too.
But let me tell you what I pulled out of last week. And it made me say, oh,
that's a playmaker right there.
Y'all saw it.
I'm the guy, right? I'm the guy.
I'm the guy.
Look out!
Trouble is coming.
Hello, everyone. This is Eagles Hall of Fame quarterback Ron Jaworski. And I am so excited to bring you the hottest new podcast for the NFL and gaming. Welcome to Jaws Picks, featuring me, Ron Jaworski, as I give you my expert analysis and predictions of each and every NFL game.
And you could hear the quarterbacks like it was a practice.
Yeah.
And man, I was just loving
hearing the quarterbacks call everything at the line of scrimmage. You know, they've kind of solved some of their problems over the last couple weeks, man. They were getting gutted on defense, but that's 53.3% correct against the spread.
Download new episodes of the Michael Irvin Podcast every Thursday and Jaws Picks with Ron Jaworski every Wednesday and Friday on all your favorite podcasting platforms.